Here's what we know. These are facts. Very early morning, November 5th, 2016, was the fifth anniversary of the death of Colin Eldredge. It was the end of a rainy Friday night in Waikiki, a Honolulu First Friday. Locals and tourists out partying it up at many of the same bars Eldredge and Special Agent Christopher Deedy stopped into on the night of their fatal confrontation. Down the street from the McDonald's where Deedy shot Eldredge, a hotel security guard stood watch, keeping an eye out for late-night brawls. There's always a security guard posted at that corner now at 1, 2 a.m., just in case of trouble. It was a relatively quiet night, though. There were no public vigils for Eldredge to mark the anniversary, no protests. But that doesn't mean the date went by unnoticed. Five years, two trials, and hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees have failed to resolve Deedy's case. But they also haven't stopped Eldredge supporters from pushing on.
Whether or not Deedy is ever brought to justice, whether or not he ever has to actually pay, he needs to know we're not going to forget.
I'm Jessica Terrell. From Honolulu Civil Beat and PRX, this is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. This is episode 9 of our first season, A Killing in Waikiki. And it's our final episode about the Deedy case. Next week, you'll be hearing personal stories from several Hawaii residents about a few of the big themes from this season. We started out this season with a lot of questions about whether Christopher Deedy should be in prison, or if he's being scapegoated because of Hawaii's long history of white mainland racism and federal intervention, about how we're supposed to judge whether and when lethal force is appropriate, and if Hawaii, one of the most diverse places on the planet, is really struggling with all this, what hope is there for the rest of America? It's time now for some answers.
Hi.
Hi, Jessica Terrell.
Do you want to do this in my office?
To try and answer the question of whether or not Christopher Deedy is being unfairly singled out, I went to go see a lawyer named Miles Briner.
I'm president of the Hawaii Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm a former deputy prosecuting attorney. I've been practicing law in the state of Hawaii nearly 30 years.
More importantly for our purposes, Briner is one of two guys that Deedy's lawyer, Thomas Otake, suggested we talk to. We spent months emailing and calling Otake, met with him twice to talk about the podcast, to try and persuade him to talk to us on the record, to share documents with us, to help us make this podcast balanced. What we got in the end were the names of two other attorneys. It was pretty exasperating, actually.
So Thomas Otake has taken the position that until the case is concluded, there's not a lot that he can comment on.
And he asked me to stand in.
So we're getting sort of stand-ins. And I think what he had been hoping you could sort of talk about was whether or not prosecutors in this case were kind of playing fairly.
There were a number of factors that suggested that the prosecutor's office was treating Mr. Deedy in an exceptional manner. They were featuring him as an example of unfettered interference by federal authorities and refused to acknowledge that he was acting in an official law enforcement capacity.
As a reminder, Deedy stood trial twice for Eldredge's death. The first trial ended in a hung jury. In the second trial, the jury found him not guilty of second-degree murder, but hung on the lesser charges of manslaughter and assault. Briner says it's important to keep in mind what was happening in Hawaii the week Eldredge was shot. The Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, APEC. Hundreds of international diplomats in town, media from around the world, all eyes on Honolulu.
In some respects, it was politically correct to prosecute Mr. Deedy. This was an opportunity for prosecutor's office, Mr. Kaneshiro in particular, to take the reins of a highly visible, high publicity case and prosecute it to the hilt and not have to worry about repercussions locally. Again, he was no local connection. Law enforcement locally wouldn't be affected by it. It wouldn't sour relations with either the Attorney General's office or with the Honolulu Police Department or with any other state police agency. So it was the perfect storm for Mr. Deedy.
The biggest issue Briner raises with prosecutors, though, their decision to pursue a third trial, this time for manslaughter.
It's like a gambler in Vegas who can't let go and is going to put his money down again and again and again on a losing proposition. And there's an old adage, when you're in a hole, stop digging. And the prosecutors didn't seem to understand that concept.
And this is where the double jeopardy arguments come in.
So double jeopardy, basically, the idea behind it is the state should get one fair, clean attempt to prosecute an individual.
That's the other guy Didi's lawyer sent me to talk to, defense attorney Rick Singh.
And the reasoning behind this goes back a long way, but it's basically that the government, in all its power and wealth and influence, shouldn't be able to come at an individual who's usually in a very disparate situation multiple times over the same thing.
Didi's lawyers have several legal arguments for why a third trial would be double jeopardy. And Singh was really helpful at breaking them down. So bear with me on some legalese for a minute, because this is important. Basically,
there's a hierarchy of offenses, murder being at the top. That requires typically an intentional knowing act. Manslaughter, reckless manslaughter, is the same death, but the intention was based on reckless conduct rather than intentional or knowing conduct.
A drunk driver speeding and killing someone in a crash? That would be an example of reckless manslaughter.
Fundamentally, you have to look at the evidence. You have to look if there was any evidence of reckless conduct resulting in the death. Now, an important aspect of this is the tactical aspect. And it really comes into play for the prosecution, because the prosecution really wants to make a decision. They look at a case, and when you really think it's murder, it may be the stronger tactical move to not instruct the jury on reckless manslaughter. And that's because you want to avoid a compromise verdict. You want the jury to come back as you see the case.
The prosecution makes a decision about what they want the charges to be, what they want the jury to decide on. And in Didi's first trial, and again in his second trial, prosecutors argued Eldert's death was straight-up murder. Didi's actions, 100% intentional. The judge agreed, but then added manslaughter as an option at the end of the second trial. The jury in that trial acquitted Didi of murder, but hung on manslaughter and assault. So prosecutors said, okay, we'll go back for a third trial on the lesser charges. Didi's lawyer appealed, arguing that this would be double jeopardy. You can't just change your mind in a murder case. You said it wasn't manslaughter. You said it was murder. Didi was acquitted of murder. You lost. You can't just keep trying until you get the results you want. There hasn't been enough new evidence discovered to justify that. The Hawaii Supreme Court agreed to hear that appeal, but it's going to be a while before that happens. So why is the prosecutor's office still going after Didi? Especially when local newspaper polls show public support for a retrial has plummeted with each passing year. Here's Honolulu County Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro.
We pursue the case as long as the law would allow us to pursue it. And I think we owe it to the victim to do that.
Unless a jury acquits Didi of all charges, or judge rules that Didi can't be retried, Kaneshiro says he has an obligation to keep seeking a conviction. I asked Kaneshiro if he had a vendetta against Didi, or if on the flip side, he was a man on a mission. Maybe he's an attorney trying to make a stand, trying to get justice where the court systems have perhaps failed to thus far. His answer was kind of disappointing, honestly. A deep passion or conviction might be more persuasive of an argument than just,
what it is we have a job to do, and we're doing our job. That's it.
So what's the answer here? It does seem like Kaneshiro has some bitter feelings about the federal government's involvement in Didi's case. But I'm going to go ahead and say that I don't think Didi's a victim of Hawaii history, of an anti-white backlash. Two separate juries of predominantly non-white locals have not only not found him guilty, but have hung in his favor when they can't reach a decision. We can say, though, that Didi's definitely not being treated like most cops. It is extremely rare for officers to be tried for killing a civilian, let alone to face repeated trials. According to a Washington Post investigation, between 2005 and 2015, 54 police officers in the United States faced criminal charges for shooting and killing a civilian. That's out of more than 7,000 deaths. So yeah, even if Dee Dee's not being scapegoated, it definitely looks like he's being singled out. But, and not to lead us down a rabbit hole here, doesn't that beg a totally different question? Is it that the Honolulu County Prosecutor's Office is treating Christopher Dee Dee unfairly? Or is it that the system itself is unfair? Are we really doing all that we should to hold cops accountable? Consider this for a minute. Between 2001 and the end of 2015, America lost nearly 7,000 soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. During the same 15 years, more than twice as many Americans died in the U.S. during encounters with cops.
I think we have to understand that this is something that is terrifying. It should be terrifying to everyone.
That's Kalamanaheyu, a doctor and Native Hawaiian activist who also serves as a spokesperson for the Eldert's family.
And people of color, they're the canary in the coal mine. You know, we actually end up suffering and identifying social ills earlier. But those social ills actually translate into affecting other people.
There's a reason why media coverage of police shootings tends to focus on people of color. It's an issue that disproportionately affects Black communities, Native American communities, Latino communities. But it's not as if cops don't fire at white people, too. Last year, 495 white people were shot and killed by police officers in the U.S.
What we're witnessing right now is a kind of struggle for the soul of American policing. Is it going to change? And there are many people within law enforcement who really sincerely believe it has to and it should.
That's David Harris, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School and the host of a podcast called Criminal Injustice.
You do see in policing a much greater openness to public input and criticism than I have ever seen in my professional lifetime, especially in the leadership ranks, saying we need a new mentality. We can't be warriors. Warriors is wrong. We have to be guardians of the public and the public peace.
Cops saying that we need to rethink use of force in America.
To make it a definite last resort and to institutionalize the idea that we should not be putting up with police shootings that are maybe lawful, but awful.
But it's still a really divisive issue.
There are forces who want to say, no, it's working fine the way it is. You people don't appreciate what we have to put up with, and we know what's best. That kind of mentality is what got us to where we are now.
What's Harris's opinion?
We need change. We've needed it for a long time. And I think this is the moment when we're either going to get it or in 25 years, we'll be right back where we started.
Ten years ago, Hawaii held another trial for the five men accused of raping Thalia Massey in the 1930s. The judge was the lieutenant governor of Hawaii. The courtroom, a convention center hosting a national meeting of the American Bar Association. There were teams of volunteer attorneys on both sides. The defendants, their accusers, all long dead. Without the ability to call witnesses, lawyers presented evidence from transcripts of original testimony, from the Pinkerton report that had concluded the men were innocent, a report buried by politicians for decades. The jury was a room full of lawyers from around the country. Their vote, unanimously in favor of acquittal. Reporters were naturally pretty skeptical and maybe even cynical folks. So when I first found an article about the mock trial, my reaction was a little eye roll. Being able to address the wrongs of the past is a lovely idea. But what good does it really do if it comes too late to be of any help to the people involved? Then, at some point in the reporting process, everything started to seem so heartbreakingly connected. Was it when I found out that Dee Dee's fraternity brother, the one who was with him in the McDonald's that night, works for a company with roots to the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom? Or maybe it was the moment I realized the academic counselor at Colin Eldert's High School was the niece of Joseph Ka'avae, the man murdered by Navy officers in 1932. Maybe our history is never as buried as we'd like to think.
We kind of come from this like cultural PTSD.
That's Brandon Maka'ava'ava, a Native Hawaiian sovereignty activist. Maka'ava'ava says the impacts of the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom in 1893 are still playing out today.
That like totally threw our people for a loss. It really like, you know, it set us back.
Thinking about what we're talking about here, and I can just see like one of the automatic responses being, okay, it's been 123 years now. Isn't it time to just get over it? And I'm wondering what your response is to that, or how you see this sort of cultural PTSD from 123 years ago,
right,
like really still being a part of not just Hawaiian's life, but your life.
Right, right. Well, you know, building a bridge and getting over it is easy if that bridge is there. We don't see that bridge. There is no, you know, even at the signing of the apology bill in 1993, where America admittedly, you know, admitted to the crime of that and promised reconciliation, that reconciliation has never come for our people. We still haven't even started to get to the problem yet. You know, it hasn't been addressed truthfully and honestly.
Do you also think that's what's going on in not necessarily Hawaii, but like in America in general right now? When we look at what's happening in the African-American community and the policing, is it that we have never come to grips with our slavery, legacy?
Yeah, with slavery, with being built on colonization of non-European people. Yeah, that hasn't ever been addressed. The genocide of indigenous peoples, you know, it's just there's an elitist type of get over it to all of us that we cannot fathom, because we never got to grieve the death of our community by the hands of these guys that are telling us to get over it. These are these deep bonds and deep wounds that we'll never get over, because nobody has consciously sat down to have that kind of discussion, to come to that kind of grips with it.
So let's try to come to grips with the big question before us today. Should Christopher Didi be in prison? It's a question that people may never reach a definitive agreement on, at least not this year, or even this decade, even if the Hawaii Supreme Court decides Didi can be tried a third time. Here's former Honolulu County Prosecutor Peter Carlisle.
I don't see that it's going to be resolved. I can't see any reason why it would be resolved if we go try it five more times. And I think a lot of that has to do with the incredible level of evidence that's already existed and the perpetual propensity for the juries not to come close to getting a decision on the case.
But remember how divided jurors were in the 1932 Massey case at first? How many people on the mainland supported the Masseys, believed that the murder of Joseph Ka'avae wasn't a crime, that it was justified? At the end of more than 6 months of reporting on these cases, here's what I can say for sure. As a society, our idea of what a crime is changes. Our idea of what is acceptable changes. If the reactions of people to the Massey case isn't strong enough evidence of that for you, look up the lynching of Jesse Washington in 1916. But only if you're ready to have nightmares, to feel sick for days. Washington was tortured for hours, burned and then hung and then burned again in front of a courthouse in Waco, Texas, before a crowd of thousands. People posed for photographs, took home body parts as souvenirs. 100 years sounds like a long time ago, but it's really not. If you're in your late 30s or 40s, you probably have a grandparent who was alive in 1916. But that was generations ago, you say. How about 1983? It was legal for a man to rape his wife in 33 states then. And if you had to take a guess what year it became illegal for the government to forcibly take Native American children away from their parents and make them assimilate into white culture, would you say 1908 or 1978? It was 1978, by the way. So yeah, things change. And by today's definition of crime, by the expectations we set for law enforcement, by our laws governing guns and drinking and self-defense, Christopher Didi probably shouldn't be in jail. Two separate juries have not been persuaded that Eldert's death was a crime. How fair is it to keep trying Didi over and over again? Will people think differently about police shootings in 10 or 20 or 50 years, though? Perceptions have changed a lot just in the last 5. Here's criminology professor David Harris again.
A lot of people who maybe wouldn't have doubted police in the past, they're taking a second look at all these issues. They're saying, well, I guess that can happen. I've seen it with my own eyes. So a lot of the narratives that African-Americans and Latinos have told people for many years, and others who never had these experiences, they doubted them. Now they're having to reconsider that.
Here's another thought that I haven't been able to shake. If our idea of what's acceptable, of what's a crime, changes, maybe it's not Dee Dee, but society that should be indicted here. Every one of us should be held responsible for making sure that our laws and behavior is fair and reasonable. For judging not whether Dee Dee should be in jail, but what should the State Department's responsibility be here? The national policies about use of force, the support and training we provide our local police. Dee Dee's still employed by the State Department, and the agency has been silent about Dee Dee's actions, not just for this podcast, but for nearly all media requests about this case over the last 5 years. They've said nothing about the status of their internal investigation, about what role Dee Dee currently serves or plays. Here's Honolulu County Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro again.
It seems like the policies were put in place to protect their own employee. And the fact that while he was out on bail, he was working. He was not on leave or anything. He was working. It's like nothing happened. How they treated him was like he didn't commit any crime.
Kaneshiro talking about Dee Dee's job at the State Department reminds me of that photo from the 1932 Massey case. Lieutenant Thomas Massey, back in his Navy uniform, just months after his conviction for killing Joseph Kaavai. Back on a submarine. Back at work like nothing happened. The expectation that society will one day judge Dee Dee differently, that's probably not much of a comfort to the Eldert's family, to people still struggling to come to grips with his loss, to find a way to remember him without picturing the violent and bloody images of his death. When Kalamina Hayu thinks of Colin Eldert's, she tries to replace those images with something else. A photo of Eldert's. He's standing in the ocean, his back to the camera.
You just see him with his silhouette and his arms spread out. He's about to jump in the water, and you can see the light coming down from the sun reflecting off of the ocean, kind of like light going through his fingers and like surrounding him. And so you don't see any details of it, but I kind of think that the way I think about it is, you know, that's him going into the next life.
When you think about Christopher Dee Dee, What do you think or feel? I mean, do you see someone who's evil? Do you see someone who's kind of stupid? Do you see someone who's arrogant? Mm. Do you see someone that you have pity or empathy for?
Well, I see him as somebody who was incredibly privileged and incredibly arrogant and who believed that he was untouchable. And I think that you can't underestimate people's ability to cast themselves as a hero of their own story. And he believes what he did was right. And I do see him almost like a symbol where he represents where America can go, you know, where if you don't face and talk about your own weaknesses and you don't deal with your own arrogance, and if you continue to try to portray yourself as the hero of the world, bad things are going to happen.
So are we at the village now?
Yeah, now we're at the village.
Okay.
Yeah, for us, this is where America ends. All those problems we were talking about earlier all ends in here. This is how we're supposed to be living.
After we visited Colin Eldert's hometown with Brandon Maka'ava'ava last summer, he drove us up into the hills, to a village where few outsiders are allowed. a place that has declared itself to be sovereign land, a home base for an arm of the Hawaiian sovereignty movement.
Do the police come onto your land here at the village?
No. So the police, whenever there's a problem, usually we don't get to a point where our problem gets to a scale where the police need to come. But if there's a complaint about something up here, they'll come to the gate and they'll talk to Uncle Steve, who lives in this guard shack. He's the head of security for our village.
The property is isolated, located on a high forested hill at the base of these lush green mountains. It's the epitome of off the grid. A few simple shacks and homes, a large open-air community structure where residents are in the process of building a kitchen.
Wow.
Yeah, so this beautiful. Is at the top of our village.
And is that color that's planted there on the hill?
We planted tea leaf. This is all tea leaf, yeah. If you go to any kind of sacred site or whatever, you'd see tea leaf planted around it. It's like an antenna for energy, you know, kind of clearing out the pathway of negative energy.
So is that what it's here for, around, sort of surrounding the village with, yeah, like, sort energy. Of protection and energy?
Yeah, yeah. You know, we kind of look at it like these are our soldiers. And not soldiers of war, but soldiers of aloha, soldiers of peace. Our idea when we first planted this tea leaf was to put something back that was endemic to our place. We tried taro and we tried sweet potato, but up here it's really tough.
I was standing on top of these terraces and looking down at the village and the ocean by the mountain. I mean, it's like incredibly peaceful here. You do sort of just feel like a exhale. Yeah.
Yeah. This is our sanctuary. This is our nation. You know, this is the dream of all our people, that one day we could get our own lands to control.
I mean, just going back and I mean, standing here in a place that's so different from Kailua or any of the other places that we've been to in Hawaii, and thinking about Colin Eldertz and kind of young Hawaiian guys growing up today.
They needed something like this. They needed this kind of like reset in their lives.
After a few months of spending all my time reporting on violence and racism and all this dark history, it was hard not to start feeling depressed. Will we ever be able to get along? Is history doomed to repeat itself? Will America ever be able to confront the ugly ghosts of its past? So I asked Maka'ava'ava, is there some hope that Hawaii can offer? He didn't hesitate, not for a second. Yeah, he said, absolutely.
I think the Hawaiian value of aloha, the true Hawaiian value of aloha, like, you know, me, I always look at the world as like a really fear-driven world. Fear is the greatest emotion in the human spirit today. That's an emotion that is gripping America and the whole world today. Aloha is the opposite of fear. Anything what fear creates, aloha is the rival to it. So aloha can, you know, mean love and all that too, but aloha can also mean courage. It's, you know, I'm not afraid of you. I can be, you know, humble in myself and know that whatever you're trying to show to me is not taking away from me. I got to give you this peace because you need that. You know, you need that. That strength is aloha. That strength to know who you are and to always fight fear is aloha.
Standing on top of the hill at the village and looking out across the terraced land to the ocean, Maka'ava'ava seems so sure, so hopeful.
So offering people aloha as a way of getting through the sort of racial mess that we're in this nation.
Yeah. When we live without fear, that's when we're going to be a peaceful place. We're going to have world peace.
This is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. Is there something that Hawaii can teach the mainland about race relations beyond the idea of aloha? And what would it mean to open ourselves up as reporters to criticism and feedback with Maka'ava'ava's definition of aloha? That's next week on Offshore. Subscribe now and tell your friends. You don't want to miss it. We want to thank our friends over at Reveal for supporting our show. Reveal's a podcast from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, and it's great. Each episode takes you into a hidden world or exposes a problem that most people know nothing about. Their reporters spend weeks, sometimes months or years, getting to the bottom of a story. Along the way, they come across the most intriguing characters. Sometimes they're good guys, sometimes they're bad. But by the end, they've revealed what's going on and who's to blame. Check it out. You can find Reveal on your local public radio station or on iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere you download podcasts. Offshore is produced by Honolulu Civil Beat, a member-supported nonprofit news organization dedicated to covering the real Hawaii. Donate to support this podcast and our journalism at civilbeat.org. Offshore is distributed by PRX. Offshore's producer and executive producer is Ben Adair. Our editor is Patty Epler. April Estrelon's our associate producer. I'll be back next week.